Test. This is Dave Crippen at the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. Today is October 22nd, 1987, and today we're privileged to be talking with Mr. Tucker P. Madawick, M-A-D-A-I-W-I-C-K. Mr. Madawick has had a long and varied career in several capacities and industries, and with an emphasis on automotive designing. And we'd like to have Mr. Madawick tell us today of his career in roughly chronological order and in his own way. Basically, Mr. Madawick, we'd like to have you start from the beginning, where you were born, who your parents were, your earliest influences in design, your schooling and training, and then your first job.
Excellent. Thanks, Dave. I think we're going to go back in time to New York City, great little town, and the little county known as Richmond. I was born in New York City, in Port Richmond, Staten Island, of all places. And father was an engineer, uncle was an engineer, and of course, the informative years go rather quickly. And I can remember all the don'ts. Don't touch this, don't sit there, don't. And of course, they went by rather quickly. And I would say really the...
What years were those?
Oh, those were from about 22 through about 25, 26.
And,
right. And during these years, Dad was in the construction business. And his brother Paul, hence my middle name Paul, was a talented engineer and would risk just about anything to prove his point. And it was enlightening to me to get down the yard on weekends where all this equipment was stacked. We had steam shovels and cranes and Mack trucks and all of that heavy gear and just the sound of engines running. And the men in those days had to crank things, didn't have the batteries to turn them over. And I think this was the motivator reel that really that tickled me as a real young boy to spend the weekends down there. You remember in those days we didn't work 40 hours. We worked a full Saturday and Sunday was the day. But the interest really in cars and anything with wheels really started then. Conversations at home, and of course the other thing that was intriguing, this was pre-diesel, and the heavy equipment in those days, cranes and shovels, used steam as the power source, which meant on weekends, Dad and I would go around these various construction sites and make sure that they would have steam up on Monday. And I was really involved with the movement of grease and noise from the early days. So I think I was destined not to be a ballet dancer. I had to have something to do with the equipment. Didn't take them long to realize that I would not go to a co-ed high school. They had chosen I would go to Brooklyn Tech, of all places. All male.
Not easy to get into either, was it?
Well, I don't believe that was the problem, but it also gave me an hour and 20-minute ride on the train every morning to go from Long Island into inner city. And Dave, in those days, Brooklyn was a polite spot, beautiful spot to live, just lovely spot. And after 4 years at Brooklyn Tech, the next choice, of course, was...
What sort of interest matured there at Brooklyn Tech in terms of mechanics? Or?
Well, here again, I was never well oriented for mathematics. They wanted me to go into aeronautical engineering, and I had a feeling for mathematics, but I could do beautiful things with the right hand. I could draw quickly, and I think it was the fact that I had a choice, even as a teenager, to go into advertising art illustration. I knew the anatomy very well, having started at Art Students League on Saturdays, which brought me into New York City.
Where was that in those days?
57th Street,
okay.
West Side. Mm-hmm. But here again, I moved quickly into the body, and nudity meant nothing to me because I remember that first bit at about 12 or 13 when I sat adjacent to this model, and yes, it was quite a revelation, but such is life. But going back to what happened there at Tech, the theme there was basically everything was engineering oriented. It was they illustrated how we made things, where steel came from, aluminum, and what you could do with these specific metals. But that went rather quickly, and on to Pratt Institute, into year one industrial design. I was the freshman class of the first freshman curriculum.
Who was the mentor of that?
We had came out of Carnegie Institute. I'll get back to his name in a moment. You took it away from me.
I'm sorry.
But we'll just have to hesitate here, and we'll get back to this great mentor, because he wasn't with us too long, and died about, well, it was a tragic death, committed suicide in the second year. And we brought in Alexander Costello then, who became head of the dean, not dean of the school, but became head of the School of Industrial Design. But it was the freshman of the pioneer class. We were number one. We were the embryo stage of design.
Spell Costello for the typist.
Beg your pardon?
Spell Costello.
Costellow. Alexander Costello. I believe he was Syrian. Very forceful, very dramatic man who was concerned about shapes and form and how you could imply these various shapes and forms into the product needs of today. To that point, Alexander was one of the first individuals to get a subsidy from General Motors. And ultimately, later in years, post-war from Ford. But we were being brainwashed in those days by GM. There wasn't anything that we could possibly not ask for, and it arrived quickly. But those were the early days. As a matter of fact, Alexander was a recipient of I believe it was a 38 or 39 Buick, lovely maroon Buick, arrived one day. And but that led us.
Your years of prep, what were they? I mean,
35 through 38, 35, 36, 37. Dave, I got a little irritation there in the third year and just couldn't continue into my fourth year. I rebelled like one of my seven children did of late, and I took off. But the days at Pratt were just great, because nobody was aware of this curriculum at all. It was known as industrial design, and I think the title was bad from a standpoint. It should have been product design or something to get us out of the bang-bang or the beat of a machine, but yet that's what we did. We did things that were mass-produced, not individually produced. They never compared us with an interior designer or a hat designer, etc. But here we were in the nucleus. We were in class number one, as I told you, and Dick Arbib is a classmate of mine, and he ultimately went on to be Harley Earl's first number one boy Friday. He was the assistant prior to Bill Mitchell and many others, but he chose General Motors based on this the assistant program, the assistance that we're getting financially in product and goodies from General Motors. He went that way, and I've never been a pro GM man. I was looking for Ford, and then of course the wave started to come through on this forthcoming World's Fair of 39 and 40, biggest thing. Very, very big since the Chicago World's Fair of 33. Didn't take me long to get cracking there and find out who was doing what and what the timetable was. And they had interviews in 38 for the job. And I'll never forget that they were held at the Brewster, the old Rolls-Royce Brewster building in Long Island City, the entrance of the Queensboro Bridge, this magnificent big building where Rolls had started in the 20s to assemble cars stateside, and where the Brewster Ford was built.
Right
there, Bonnie. And
the new era.
Right. Didn't take me long to leave Pratt. I had suitcase immediately and proceeded on to Durbin and Bob Gregory, and I had a job.
How this come about? You just came out?
Well, no, we were screened.
Had interviews at the
interviewed in Long Island City.
Okay.
And then on to Durbin. And
how did that give us a little bird's eye or thumbnail sketch of your impressions of Durbin? Impressions of the Ford designs as it was.
Well, just driving by this morning, boy, it all came back because the building is still there, the lake is still there, right. Everything is still there, but right. You've taken all the green grass away and you've put cars in place of the, but these things happen. But I'll tell you what, the thing that made me rather secure immediately, I had a good glimpse or an understanding, but we knew that Ford was different than General Motors and different than Chrysler. They were three different personalities, and there was enough written about Henry Ford, and we knew that he was not pro-union. We knew that we didn't have a steel top. We didn't have hydraulic brakes. He was one who you couldn't tell this great man just what to choose and what to wear and what to buy. And these were not irritants that didn't make any difference to me because I had a 35 Ford Phaeton like that one up there then. And that was the greatest machine. That was something. And drove out here in it with outside curtains. Didn't need side curtains. And if it snowed, you put newspapers on the seat.
Right.
And you'd shake the newspapers out of it.
Right.
It was very, very simple. Matter of fact, the one I had 2 inches of concrete poured in the back of the front seat, between the seats right on the floor where you came up with the tunnel for the drive shaft. They needed weight back there. And so I had it. It was great. It was great in the wintertime.
I
with
bet
that.
I did.
But I believe it was Gregory who really secured gave me the confidence that this was a great spot. He had a great warm personality, and the engineers in those days, matter of fact, all of the contemporaries here in body engineering, didn't meet very many of the marketing people, but it was engineering oriented. They were known by their dark blue suits, their white socks, brown shoes, and white shirts. It was a uniform they all wore.
Right, and their hats.
And their hats. They always had a fedora hat. And here was Bob Gregory, handsome, Welsh, Scotch, Irish, or something like that, with a beautiful Glen plaid suit. And he had buckskin suede shoes on. And wow. And then that spring, we had the seersuckers. And this man was totally different.
Yeah, right.
He had an air. He had something to sell. And you could see it. And the opposition, of course, was there. It was definitely there because all we had to do was contrast what was going on at General Motors and Chrysler.
You must have been pleased to see those photos of him before and after.
Oh, yes.
At the SAE
yes.
Meeting yesterday.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he had a boat. Of course, I came out of Long Island. Ultimately, we went from Staten Island to Long Island.
That's right. You were kinsmen. So.
Right, and spent a lot of time on the water. And he would ask us, a certain group of us, there was about three or four of us, that would get down to the yard where he kept the boat, and he'd take us out.
Down at Grossy Hill?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Who was in that group, by the way?
Well, there was Duncan, myself.
Duncan McRae?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Bob Thomas, uh-huh. Eddie Martin.
Eddie Martin. Right.
Eddie always had a hand in that.
Yeah.
And I don't forget today when the diesel engine arrived at the plant on wood skids.
Uh-huh.
And we normally knew what was going on because you had heavy security here, and nothing would come in or go out in those days.
Right.
Matter of fact, the gate out here is the same where Doug and I would go out and grab a little cigarette.
Right. Uh-huh.
But one day this...
This is at the engineering lab.
Engineering lab at the Styling.
Right? Yeah.
This thing arrived. It was a beautiful red color, and it was a diesel engine. I don't know where it came from, Germany or someplace, but... Well, okay, we said, here we go, new design job. It's going to go into the tractor. It's going to go into the new trucks that we were doing. And no, it didn't, because 2 weeks later, Bob said, what are you guys doing this weekend? I was married then.
Uh-huh.
And Duncan had just married the Kresge heiress.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you about that story.
Uh-huh.
And why? Well, he said, I want to put a new engine in the boat. And that was fun, I'll tell you that much. We had, it was all manpower, and we put same into it, and she was a beautiful, beautiful catch, two-mast black hull. We just went up and down the river. I'd say then she was about a 40-footer.
Wow.
Very comfortable, very comfortable. He loved anything to sail. He really did, he really did. And it was a wonderful escape, although we found no problem at work. To me, the days went fast, and being young, and of course, there was only a handful of us there. You get down to Waller Creek, you know the names as well as I do. And Johnny came in a little later.
He came in about 39, didn't he?
He came in a little later, and they'll forget that, and came out of your Ford
Trade school
and whatnot. Very polite guy, terrific, yeah. Hard worker.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had the Ellis Rigitko, and was a heavy chairman who did all of the, took all the offsets, and they must have then been in their mid-40s, and there we were in our early 20s, so there was, and you had Gregory in between, who was in his early 30s.
Bob Gregory told me a story about Frank Francis, of changing his name.
Yes, we were not aware of that.
You were aware of that.
Well, as a matter of fact, Dave, you couldn't find a woman within 2 or 3 miles from here. I imagine even if we knew the a woman.
Oh, yeah.
They were as scarce as sliced bread then. You couldn't find them anywhere. So it was all male, 100% male. Because yeah. I remember we came up, Charles Lindbergh had an office there, finally.
Yeah, later, yeah.
Right, and he had a male secretary, but you just... You
almost no females there.
No females at all. Yeah, really couldn't.
I think it's true through most of the industry, especially at Ford. Mm-hmm. Very much so. What about Benny Barbera? Was he there too?
Boy, that's familiar. Name is very familiar.
He's still at Ford.
He still is.
Yeah.
I'll be done.
He must be about 69.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the, there was an engineer named Martin. He was a, the top, he had a young son that came in there for a while. But.
Well, it was a hearty little band of almost completely compatible people.
That's correct. Yeah. And Bob would schedule things. Now, we did the 27-passenger bus, we did the tractor, mm-hmm. we did the Ford trucks, we did the Lincoln Mercury, Continental, and we had to really move.
Oh, not bad.
But it was never sweat. It was mm-hmm. just,
low key
and a good, wonderful atmosphere.
I think it was partly, as you suggest, partly due to Bob's low-key approach, plus Edsel Ford's low-key approach.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And we also knew, now, we had a day's warning. It went right down, just like a blast off at Cape Canaveral, when Henry Sr. was coming through.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Oh, we knew that, and of course, there followed the entourage.
Sure.
They were there,
mm-hmm.
all the way down.
Charlie Sorensen.
Da, 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 all the way down.
Yeah.
Last man, we didn't have too much to say. He was the last man. There were the hats.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And we never forget... Henry was driven around, and he had a two-door, and in the front quarter, he had two bottles of mineral water.
Uh-huh.
He carried his own water with him. I assume it was water now.
Yeah,
it's a good
sure
assumption.
Was.
And then, of course, lunch, we broke bread with him right in the cafeteria.
Yeah.
And there was nothing.
There was no executive cafeteria,
no.
Not, at least not in the engineering department.
No.
It was elsewhere.
Now, this wasn't every day, but when they came over and happened to be there, that was it. They would all sit at their table. And they conversed just as loud. It wasn't monotone at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very proud of this. That a good example was the day of the big blast when Reuther exploded and the union and the railroad ties and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only ones permitted to come in. We just drove around the ties right here.
We figured.
These kids, what, Bob Gregory, what could he possibly do? They're looking at things 2 or 3 years
sure
in advance,
right,
and we went right past all the goons, and in those days, I watched it was 75 cents an hour.
Oh, was it?
And I heard what Gordon said yesterday,
yeah,
referring to his $3.50 a month,
right,
and 35.
Right.
Well, you just multiply 30 times 4 is 120. But that's what we came in at. And I was very, very proud and bought
sure
that car and lived very rich. Finally got a lovely apartment over here on Wiscasset in the Ford, buildings built by the Ford Foundation.
Yeah, they call them the Ford, the Ford Foundation?
No, the buildings that...
they call them Ford Homes.
Ford Homes.
The old tractor. They were built for the tractor.
Well, I don't know, but it was not a high rise. It was two stories and we had a top apartment. And then
the Ford Foundation. Then, okay.
That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Very pleasant.
Oh, very pleasant.
And I don't know what that cost us, but...
They're very sought after.
Yeah. It was just ideal, and a nice little customer, and we met. And, of course, Duncan went on to marry this great Kresge heiress. Her
Which
dad
was...
Well, he'd been married so many times, Duncan. I'd have to have pad and pencil to trace him.
What was the... Was she Sebastian Kresge's daughter or sister? Or what?
I've forgotten over the years.
Yeah, okay.
Because... they lived in Bloomfield Hills. She had a lovely home. And Duncan, being a proud Scotsman, would not tolerate the chauffeur delivering on weekends the food basket. And of course, she received a convertible. And Duncan had a 36 Phaeton, like I had the 35. And it took 1 year. He threatened and said, if you don't stop doing it, I've married your daughter, not you. and just like McRae,
that was the end of it.
It didn't faze him a bit. Didn't faze him a bit. The world was still large, and it was his.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Lots of pretty women out there.
Oh, yeah.
But getting back to Ford, I would say it was the environment was good. It was tops.
Yeah.
And we were growing then. Ford, you could see we were growing. You had a Continental. You had some new, fresh cars emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And across the street, of course, you had that big parade of octave from Chevy all the way up to, the Cadillac. And they, in turn, were offering, I would think, more variety in color.
Mm-hmm.
We were concerned about color and some of the design nuances that we wanted to do and couldn't quite do it, like the control ventilators. There was a lot of things out there that were protected with patent rights that finally they were licked, and it gave us a compatible car with competition, at least.
What was the setup in the design studio? Did you have state-of-the-art material in terms of clay?
We had the best. Uh-huh. We had absolutely the best in clay. We had the best in ovens. We had the best in bridges, aluminum.
Mm-hmm. That had been something of a innovation by
it was by Gregory. I don't know whether it came out of
Bill Wagner possibly too.
Bill too, by the way. Bill added another dimension that was really well. There was Walter Krug, Bill Wagner, the same age of a little older, as a matter of fact, than Bob Gregory.
Uh huh. Right.
They're a little older because Bob told me the story about how they'd go out and have lunch, Walter and myself, in about 1935-36, and they spotted the Stutz down here on the Detroit lot, which he bought for $450.
Oh.
Great car, and he said he couldn't park it anywhere, so that people just, wow, they wonder who they were. But Walter, is a very handsome entrepreneur. I don't know, I know Walter came out of an Ivy League school, I know
Walter
that.
Krug,
yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And tell me about Walter. What was his discipline?
He was tall, lovely wife. He added that dimension known as class.
Uh-huh.
Totally different than Bob, but well-spoken, well-read.
Mm-hmm.
And he did interiors, of course. He had
did
a flair
he?
For fabric
uh-huh.
and leather. Colors. Knew it all colors. He knew them all very well.
Mm-hmm.
Where I believe Johnny, what was his name, Walker, did the basic instrument panel. But it was Walter who did the whole galaxy of Ford Park. He did all the interiors.
Eddie Walter. Oh, Walter Krug, I'm sorry, yeah.
Walter Krug.
Yeah.
And the other chap who did the, was last name was Walters, who did the basic panels. And then there was, of course, Eddie Martin was always in and out. He was a confidant. He was very close to Bob Gregory.
Yeah.
Very, very close. And I think he was the one that opened many doors and closed those doors for Bob over the years. And
he claims he did the first model of the Continental.
Eddie did?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't doubt it a bit because, as we know, when Bob did the little 10th scale drawing,
right.
they immediately made a 10th scale model, and that was the one that they took offsets off
right.
for Martin Regetta.
Yeah, right.
That's unbelievable to go from that petite scale.
Mm-hmm. What was it, about a
quarter scale? It's like, no, this was 10th scale.
10th scale, yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. And that was it. As a matter of fact, I've got some. I want to show these to you. These are a series of 10-scale drawings that we did here in those days. And if you got a pair of binoculars, or do you have a magnifying glass?
It would be best for our listening audience for you to describe it as well as you can.
Okay, very good. But these are 10-scale drawings right there.
And these are.
And these were done by old T.P. Tucker, and they were basically the 1942 and 43 lines that were interrupted
mm-hmm.
by the war. These were done in 1941 and 1940. And as I say, they were 10 scale. That would be the size of the car wheelbase right mm-hmm. to there. We'd be about 10 scale. And these are the Ford Mercury and Lincoln Zephyr. These were the proposed Lincolns.
Mm-hmm.
And
for 42 or 43?
42. See, we were interrupted in 41.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And of course, these never materialized at all.
Yeah.
Never did. And then the fastbacks, we decided then to really,
right.
really come out with a fastback.
Well, those would have been striking, wouldn't they?
They would have been in those days.
Yeah.
But these were just quickies. Now, we would do four or five of these a day.
These were your drawings?
They're all Team Adderwicks. You can see all Team Adderwicks.
Okay,
you know,
good.
All
okay.
of them.
Great.
Uh-huh. These were great.
You do four or five of those, basic finished sketches a day.
Right, yeah. Ross and I.
Ross Cousins.
Ross Cousins and I. Ross.
Now, was Cousins a full member of the staff or was he a part time?
He was full member. Ultimately, he was full member.
Was
yeah.
he? Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know what happened to him when we had the intrusion when the World War II came in. Mm-hmm. But
he went into advertising illustration.
That's correct. He did. He did. Because we did work with J. Walter Thompson. Then J. Walter Thompson would come in with their proposal. I got some of their ads in here, and we would run a critique. Johnny Wallace, who did the instrument panel, would make sure that the artist rendering and everything they did was correct.
Yeah.
And then Duncan and I and Bill Wagner would do the exterior to make sure the hubcaps are the right hubcaps and the wheels and the proportions and everything else.
Uh-huh.
And you would write a little approval on it. Ooh, and it would go on. Yeah. It would go on. I think we drifted. We moved right by the World's Fair.
Please go back to it, yes.
And
the Ford exhibit in 1934 in Chicago.
Let's go beyond that. Let's go into 39 and 40.
Yes, right, yes.
And here we have an original throwaway that if you attended the fair, this is what you would take home back to Iowa and say, look where I was, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can see the cars here. There we have the standard Ford and the deluxe Ford. The previous year was always the standard model,
mm-hmm.
and then the Mercury, Lincoln Zephyr, and the big Lincoln.
And a map of the fair itself.
Map of the fair itself, mm-hmm. and we had down here, we were down with General Motors and Chrysler. General Motors was number one, we were number two, and Chrysler was number three. Bell Geddes did the General Motors building.
Yes.
He was one of the great.
Bell Geddes and Bill Spear Jr.
They were. Really?
Yes, he worked for Bell Geddes on the Futurama.
Oh, Peter. Yeah. There you are.
Yeah, he was the young.
Had to been.
Uh-huh.
Oh, beautiful. Walter Owen Teague did the Ford building.
The interior, yeah.
Did the interior, and really the whole concept.
Yeah,
the whole concept was him. And of course, what you did, the excitement, and I shouldn't say that because it was unfair, was the ride around the building in the Ford.
Magic Skyway, did they call it?
That was it, right. And you would hear these doors slamming all day long because you had to put four people in the car. Sometimes the kids would have to be in the back car and they would cry and there would be a hold up.
Do you remember, did you have any input into the Ford?
Yes. We worked, and there was a matching sheet like this that illustrated within the building a rotunda that must have been, I think it was 90 foot in diameter, that turned very slowly, and you in turn could either make the tour 360 or stand still and everything would, and the whole history of the Ford Motor Company would unfold, and it would include the raw metal, the iron ore coming out of the Mesabi Range, the rubber, the glass, that everything, you know, we were making
the wool and the cotton.
Everything. And,
yes.
And that spun down, revealing at the bottom level the completed car. Uh-huh. And you had this parade of cars. And you had these little animated figures that would serve them making, cutting, doing, drafting, and whatnot. So it was quite a revelation. Little 3D uh-huh. figures, all totally animated, moving,
mm-hmm.
and this thing turning around. Now, the outside of that area, Dave, is where we had the exhibits, and let me show you what they consisted of. I think this is one area that you were not familiar with, but here we have, there is the Tucker working away there.
Well, can you explain what these are in audio terms?
Surely.
Okay.
Surely. We had the rotunda,
mm-hmm.
center core,
right.
And around the outer peripheral area of the rotunda, we had a series of small exhibits manned by two or three people. You had the pitchman, mm-hmm. because if you tired of the rotunda, you could then go on a tour, and you'd spend about 5 minutes at each one of these little satellite displays.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the one that I was involved in was the style leaders, and there's a large blackboard, 8 by 24 feet, and on that large blackboard we would sketch throughout the season full-scale drawings of the Ford, the Mercury,
in pastel, uh-huh.
on this large blackboard.
And how many would you do a day?
Well,
probably one a day.
Not even that.
Yeah.
We would possibly to do the three cars, it would take about 3 weeks.
Oh, 3 weeks. Uh-huh.
And we had two shifts. We would start at 10 in the morning
mm-hmm.
until 4 in the afternoon. And then I had a buddy whose name I can't recall right now.
This was the black paper, wasn't it? Yeah. That
yes.
Worked on. Yeah, the standard black paper.
Uh-huh.
Was that Coniston paper in those days?
No, this was real board.
Oh, real board.
This
oh.
is real board.
And you mean slate?
Yes.
Oh, a oh, real black paper?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
And we in turn then could, we'd hose it down and wipe it all off
okay.
and
start
all over again.
Uh-huh.
You start all over
so
again.
So you use colored chalk and...
use pastel,
and
rub it with your fingers.
Uh-huh.
And cloth.
Marvelous.
And you can
so you would create those maybe every 3 weeks?
Something like that. At least every month you would come up with something new.
Go from it. They could see, watch you starting from a bare sketch to the finish.
That's correct. And if you look at the front end, we had a little display down below here. Here you can see the evolution of the car. And then these little petite galleries here took you in.
You were explaining the petite galleries. Showed the
yes.
evolution of the car in the design studio.
Right, and they were little facsimiles, Dave, of what was going on back in Dearborn.
Mm-hmm.
And you could, in turn, spend another 2-3 minutes there and watch this little turntable go around. You could see the bridges, you could see the clay being applied, you could see the finish models, and you could see how the bucks were made with the slatted wood. But here again, it was...
Buck is the armature they put the clay
that
on.
That is correct.
Usually wood at this point.
It was wood.
Yeah.
But here again, another storyboard. General Motors did not have this. We
they
were
very didn't.
No, they did
yeah,
not.
Great.
They took you on the trip through the highways and the roads of tomorrow, if
right.
you remember,
yeah,
which was very, very well done. But here we had an opportunity to at least even show my family and other faculty members there at Pratt Institute.
Oh,
yes, at
yes. What you were doing.
What we were doing. Because we were new as a profession, very, very new as a profession then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the same thing, of course, occurred at Frigidaire and in steam locomotives and practice and whatnot. It's the same theory unfolding of clay bucks and choice and then ultimate manufacture. But we had 2 good years here. Now, in the meantime, of course, we went back to Dearborn. And
oh, you spent 2 years at the fair?
Yeah, 39 and 40.
Good heavens.
39 and 40. Now, we were open from April to, I believe, October 1.
Uh-huh.
And,
where'd you stay when you were there? Did you have relatives in Long Island?
Or? We stayed in a hotel.
A hotel? Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was nicely done, and working from 10 to 4, that wasn't too shabby.
No,
that
no.
was a beautiful, no matter whether you were the afternoon or the day swing, you had plenty of time.
Who were your colleagues? Do you remember some of the people from the design studio?
No, they were not.
They were
not. The gentleman that we hired the same time that I came on board was really an illustrator.
Uh-huh.
And he remained back there in the city, never got into automotive at all, but he could sketch well, could apply the pastel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe anybody wanted to leave the Detroit area then.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good question. Come to think of it, why didn't they bring somebody out of home office? I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that. Never did.
So you enjoyed your stay?
It was good. And then, of course, meeting others from General Motors and from Chrysler.
Right.
And I told you about the month or so that young Henry Ford came in. He was a pitchman. And in all these little exhibits around the peripheral area, you had one man describing what was being done and others doing it. Now, I had a pitchman here who was a graduate out of Fordham University. Frank Taylor was his name. And he, in turn, would describe what we were doing up there. And he had a pitch that would last about 4.5 minutes. And then the next one would come on. You would wait until you had at least 10, 20 people, curious ones looking, and then you would hit them with that message.
Tell us about the HF2 episode. You told me, but I don't think it was on the tape.
Well, one of these days, of course, we knew that there was a Henry Ford, and there was a Benson, there was a William Clay Ford. And this much I do know, that Henry was the same age that I am. He's 70. And lo and behold, one day, I imagine it was when the schools closed there in end of May, we had the real Henry Ford II.
He'd come down from New Haven, perhaps.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. The real one, right there working with us, and
great.
No problem.
Uh-huh, yeah, very Democratic.
He looked very much as if, you know, Gregory was dressing him. He had the buckskins, and he looked a little different from the Rouge boys. I'll tell you that much. Yeah. But that was about it. We never got rather intimate. But I remember one evening going over to the big Schaefer building. Schaefer was the big beer then, and when you're 22, that's all you think about in those days, the good glass of beer. And I know he palled around with a couple of boys from St. Louis, who were also Yaleys.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was lots of fun. He didn't last long. I would say a little month and a half, and then he went on to better things, no doubt Europe. I don't know.
Well, his father, I think, wanted him to get some seasoning in all phases of the company. He probably thought that'd be a good official story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your stint with the magic atmosphere of the fair is over. What's in store for you there?
Well, back to Durban, and then we have clouds. We have...
Now, this is about 40...
This was, 40 back to Durban and back on the board.
19,
we always had a board.
Right.
It had been full of 40 on the board, and of course we had our friend Hitler marching through Poland in 39 and disturbing a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't take long. The clouds were there. Something was coming, and it was then I do remember that we stopped work one or 2 weeks, and there was a funny thing called a Jeep. It was a little four-wheel bit.
Really?
Yeah. And Ford was vying for that contract then.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on our GI clothes, and I remember I was doing wiring diagrams. We were doing, I imagine it was material for a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had blow-ups of the car and what you could do, extensions and additions to the basic vehicle.
Did Ford do some prototypes?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What year was that, do you think?
That had to have been 40.
40, yeah.
It preceded the Pearl Harbor bit.
Was this the Bantam, or the Bantam prototype was floating around, or what?
I don't know.
Or was it the Willis?
I think Bantam, Willis, and even Ford, everybody had a crack at doing something.
Yeah, right, but I think Bantam had the basic
I think they did. I think it was Bantam that did.
They got aced on there.
Uh-huh. But that was about the first glimpse of, hey, this is what it looks like. And it didn't take long after that into 41.
Did
when
you
it
call it a Jeep in those days?
Did we?
Did you guys call it a Jeep?
No. No, it was not known as a Jeep then. That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, all-terrain, something like that. Yeah. But I never forget Pearl Harbor Day, though. Lois, wife number one, Lois and I... we're driving up to have dinner with Bill and his wife, Wagner Willis.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And we were on the Great Road there, Telegraph, heading north up to Franklin, the town that time forgot where Bill lived.
Right, yeah.
That great 41 Ford I had with that great Ford radio, we picked it up.
Picked it up, right, yeah.
We were listening to the symphony, Shostakovich.
Ben Brower and Bill, who were the announcers in those days?
Oh, you're close.
Yeah.
Winchell or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And heard that and continued on, and we had a couple of toddies then and said, now what's going to happen now?
Right.
Boom.
Yeah.
And it sure did happen. And then the time came, and here again, they were very generous. You can stay with us, don't worry about, you want to go to war, go to war. If you want to stick around and make things, stay with us. And I chose Willow Run.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. I'd flown then a little bit, and I said, well, okay, yeah, we're going to go. We're going to go at Willow Run, and that was a monster, of course.
Oh.
Gosh, humongous, awesome.
What year did you go out there? 41?
No, it was...
Early
42, because we followed Bird 1 right down.
Did you?
Number 1 right down, and...
what sort of work did they have you do?
Callie, I went into... inspection.
Mm-hmm.
From inspection, I went to pre-flight. And then Ford started to see this as a real war.
Right.
And in those days, you had a lot of plants. You had what, St. Louis, you had them all over.
Mm-hmm.
And to protect the investment, they started to bring in their manufacturing talent into Willow Run.
Right.
And I wound up on the evening swing. Of course, we were working 3 shifts a day then. And they started to push those who had started out day number one. They were pushing us further back. And in my contact in the inspection department with Consolidated Quality, who were the prime contractors, I had a good front door entrance into San Diego and their big new plant in Fort Worth. And I said, hey, no go. And I said, I'm going to leave, and that was very, very quick. I had gasoline galore because living in Durban and driving out to Willow Run, I waited for the for my new books to arrive, and then and they said, well, that's fine, but if you don't bring the book back, you don't get your pay. It was very, very simple. I gave them the damn book. But we had friends. Everybody tore off.
A couple of you get out of San Diego. Yeah.
Well, I made Fort Worth first.
Of course.
Because they had the new satellite plant there.
Yeah.
And I knew all of them because they had
what
been.
What had they offered you in terms of?
I became a production coordinator. Because being an inspector, I had the knowledge, I had to know the knowledge of every longeron, every bell frame, every cord, everything on that bird.
Right.
The tolerances expected. And so I wound up with a beautiful job, and I had six people working for me. I had a good tooling man, an engineer. I had a hydraulics man, electrical, and it was just wonderful.
We sometimes forget that Consolidated Valti was, of course, the prime contractor.
That's what they were.
And yeah. That Ford was simply a large sub.
That's correct. And so I went with the mother concern, and that was quite a wonderful partnership. And it went from, I was busy between San Diego and Fort Worth and Elizabeth City. We were building the PBYs, the B-24s, and the Coronados, and the B-32, and became project coordinator on the
privateers. Were you doing the privateers?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a single vertical stabilizer instead of the twin.
Yeah.
And did a lot of flying, and it's just great. Made a lot of money,
sure.
7 days a week.
Did you go to San Diego eventually?
Oh, yes.
You stayed in Fort Worth?
Stayed in Fort Worth, but commuted really out of there into their satellite plans, and I never forget how proud I was when I flew up in a Liberator and landed at Willow Run and got out and met Bill Wagner. Bill was doing cutaways at Willow Run, and old Tucker came in. It was just great to see the guys again.
Oh,
trying to think of the other bloke, can't think of his name right now, who was also doing, was Bill Schmidt? I don't know. Somebody was doing exploded views. Just, but anyway. That's correct. And then, of course, 45 came around, PJ and VE Day, and I only had one thought, get back into the design racket. And I'd married Lois. Lois also went to Pratt Scholarship student, and when we were in Detroit here, she did all the fashions for Himmelhose. You remember Himmelhose?
Oh, yeah.
She was well paid, and when we moved into Fort Worth, didn't take her long to borrow the car and go over to Neiman Marcus, and she did their Christmas catalog. She always made three times as much money as a Tucker did. Quickly.
You're right, yeah.
Real career gal. Uh-huh. And but we had our goals. We had Tucker and Paula that were born during the war. Well, Tucker was born before the war, so I had a way out. Yeah, born in the Henry Ford Hospital here.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a way out as far as the draft and whatnot was concerned. But what do you do then? And everything was just exploding. You remember that? Headed back to New York City, interviewed by Walter Dorn Teague, Louis, Dreyfus, all of them.
Really?
Yeah. Had no problem getting, because I had the experience.
Sure.
I was early out of Pratt, and I had served my apprenticeship at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had this accelerated aircraft bit,
right.
And I knew what an aircraft was. And of course, the first thing we did was to do interiors for Northwest United, getting the DC-4s, the DC-6s, DC-7s, and if you knew the anatomy of an airplane, it was a help, and I knew materials. So I fitted well in there. And Loewy said, we're going to reopen our London office, and we'd like to have you go back out to South Bend first before you go to Europe.
What year was this?
This is in 46. Yeah, because Bob had been working on the post-war student bike all during the war.
Bob Burke. Yeah.
They were in-house, X and M, and never did leave that site.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Mr. Lowy, totally impossible. I said, I have spent my apprenticeship or whatever in Durban, and I'm a big New York City man. He said, no, you don't know what Bob Burke is doing. Mm-hmm. He's doing nice things. We're going to have a car that will disturb the big three. Mm-hmm. We're working on a Studebaker. Unusual, unique, innovative. I said, no, sir, I can't go back to South Bend. That was at least five notches down from Durbin.
Right.
And there was this J. Gordon Lippincott. Now, J. Gordon Lippincott was a faculty member at Pratt.
Was he really?
And
how did his name come up in this context?
Well, during the war, he had busied himself and decided to open up, leave Pratt, and open up a design studio in New York City.
Oh.
So he had Teague, Dreyfus, Loewy, Bill Geddes, and J. Gordon Lippincott.
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about the various.
Design,
items,
right. And Gordon was at 500 Fifth Avenue, 42nd and 5th, 55th floor, beautiful offices. And boy, I said, well, forget that, Mr. Loewy, and we'll see you one of these days. And Gordon said, come on board. And he then had the Republic account where they made Thunderbolts, P-47s,
right.
And they had a beautiful 400 mile an hour, 40,000 feet turbocharged airliner that would take 40 passengers, and we had that account too in the interior and exterior. And the CB, remember the CB, little amphibian? So that was my little account there, and I commuted from the village, drove out to Farmingdale every day. In those days, it was no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got the Tucker account.
He did? So what, the advertising account?
No, he got the design account.
Design account?
So this is the conflict I had yesterday with Alec Pemberlitz, because all these days,
the whole story ends, because I don't think it's been told elsewhere.
No, and by the way, I do have a book in here. We have the Tucker book, which will be out this spring.
Great.
Looks like Automotive Quarterly now is going to publish it, because they're owned by CBS. And it's a little irritant over the years, and I've known Alex for 30, 40 years. He's never admitted to the world. Well, you know, I took Bob Burke. We had to wait for Loewy to die, and then this revelation comes through.
Well, let's review it in some detail, because I think it's important that you get this on the record.
Well, we'll do it rather quickly.
Design history.
We'll do it rather quickly, Dave. We know that DeLorean was quite an entrepreneur, but Preston Tucker could match him any day. And in the 30s, met Harry Miller, the great Indianapolis guy who had accomplished 11 wins in between the 20s and the 30s. That's a lot of wins on this front-wheel drive. Oppenhaus had injured Miller.
Yeah,
the Miller Harts. Harry Harts was driving for him, and it didn't take Preston long to hold hands with Harry Miller, and he wanted to get Henry Ford involved into it. And that didn't work. Henry said no, but he persisted, and it never did mature. But based on the knowledge he gained from Harry, well, they were four cars that he put a five into the race, right? But
he convinced Edsel. Edsel had to convince the old man. The old man said, well, we'll see how it goes.
That's correct. Yeah.
Good
so
photograph of Preston and Edsel. And
that's correct.
Down at Indianapolis.
That is correct. So it did work, but then that was another happenstance.
They came a cropper in the race. They didn't finish, did they?
No, they didn't. They didn't. They were basically, but they were good-looking cars, I'll tell you that much. They were good-looking cars. But he pursued, and during the war, of course, he...
What was the Tucker doing?
He was an advisor in Washington, D.C. on heavy arm equipment and tanks. And his job was to accelerate the over-the-rough terrain bit, what he could do in hydraulics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where he got this whimsical note about hydraulic drive, because the turrets then were hydraulic. Everything on a war tank was really hydraulic, the same as your bulldozers today. And he figured if you could get a torque converter, you get an engine and a hydraulic pump. And in his early ads, he said, we'll eliminate 800 parts. Kind of an engine up front, the hydraulic pump, a torque converter, and we will move this beautiful juice through,
mm-hmm.
and you'll have a quiet ride, and the car will last forever, and nothing will ever wear out. But this all came out of his 4 years as an advisor during
the
ordnance department during war, and he accomplished a lot of friends. Hence, securing the big Dodge plant, 575 acres, nearly 600 acres, with no dollars. The man could swing anything. Well, it was then that he decided to do something about this conceptual study that he had. his theory was that the pre-war cars were top-heavy, true. They were too heavy, true. The engines were pathetic.
Underpowered.
The brakes were underpowered. Couldn't even stop an underpowered car then. He went through this whole list, a laundry list of philosophies. The aircraft had hydraulic brakes, they had disc brakes. And he got into the safety angle. He said, we'll have two things. The car will just have two things up forward plus the wheel. It'll have a brake and accelerator. That's all that you need. You want to go forward? Just accelerate. You want to stop? Simple. No gear shift. Woman could see this thing. Oh, he played right into the feminine hearts.
Yes.
He had the car that they wanted. Cyclops headlight, which was not new at all because the Tatra had one. Cyclops headlights go back many, many years.
But the movable feature was...
was unique, later,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, of course, he had a lot of parallels. He had the Tatra that Led Winke had designed in the late 20s. L-E-D-W-I-N-K-A. Hans Led Winke. Winke. Great, talented guy, Czech by birth, Austrian. And he had Ferdinand Porsche. I never realized that both these guys are Hungarian.
Really?
We always thought, and I'm Hungarian, I want you to know.
Really?
I'm Hungarian. Uh-huh. That's why I'm pro here all of a sudden. I always thought that Freddie Porsche came out of Stuttgart. He did not. Out of Bavaria, like the rest of the good guys. But anyway, he had enough evidence there that the thing could be done. Now, not in the sophisticated hydraulic drive, but rear engine was there. He knew where the weight should be. All that philosophy turned out to be true. But it was then that he secured the talent of one George Larson.
Larson.
George Larson headed the Buick studio in the 30s, in General Motors. And during the war, found time at Briggs. That was his little sanctuary.
Uh-huh.
You either worked for Briggs, Murray, or Convair, and you were immune to marching. Preston found him in 46 and identified these design goals. And sure enough, he sketched them. George did.
Awesome.
At the cycle, and he had the cycle fenders and a teardrop in the back, and they called it the Tucker Torpedo. This is very interesting. In December of 46, it appeared in Science Illustrated. In Popular Mechanics, you had Science Illustrated. Big full page on the cover, the Tucker Torpedo, the car of tomorrow.
Was this a prototype or the
design? Purely sketch.
Okay.
Done by Larson, beautiful sketch. He teased the world. He upset everybody. Everybody said, this man Tucker's got it. That Christmas, the New Year's following that Christmas, or that December issue, New Year's Eve, December 46, he met young Alex Tremulous.
Where did they meet you?
In Chicago. In Chicago. And sold Alex. Now, Alex, you know, came out of right field. He spent the 4 years doing Zoom stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he had the Zoom philosophy. He knew all about hydraulics. He knew all about rockets, jet propulsion.
Right.
You put these two nuances together, you got something. And it was then that Alex wanted to be retained as a consultant. Sure enough, changed his mind. Alex changed his brother. Preston changed his mind and said, look, you belong in the family of Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
You become my chief designer, chief stylist, and this new used plant that I'm about to get, and that's how it all started. So here you have Science Illustrated in December 46 talking about the Tucker Torpedo. Then, in the spring of March the 2nd, big full-page ads in the New York Times and Herald Tribune, you now have the 1948 Tucker conceived by Alex Tremulous. So within the matter of 3 months, this man is teasing the world. First the Tucker Torpedo, second the new Tucker.
Now, what did you and your firm, what was your input?
March of the same year, when the New York Times ad came out, something happened to Preston. Either he was curious or questioned the validity of the concept that Alex was doing, because they forgot about the Tucker Torpedo that Larson had done. And went shopping again, and stopped in, of all places, 500 Fifth Avenue, at the offices of J. Gordon Lippincott. And sure enough, Gordon said, look, we haven't done anything. We've been talking with Willys, who were then trying to produce an America Aero car, or something like that. And he said, I've got a staff. that's when he hired me. He called me and said, look, I've got this Tucker account. Will you come on board? And I said, who is Tucker? Well, got the job, and the task force was conceived. There was Madovic and a couple of them, wonderful Germans, Reed Bemeister, Bud Steinhilber, and young Phil Egan, the Irishman, who was an MIT dropout, who forgot about the math and just loved the aesthetics. And so the four of us became a team and off to Chicago. And they shook hands, and the fee was, believe it or not, between $40,000 and $50,000 in advance. Jay Gordon was sharp, just as sharp as Preston. Mm-hmm. He said, you have no plant. I don't even know who you are. You have no address. And of course, he got the money. That was it. Very true. Couldn't spell it anyway.
No, no. Where is it?
So the thing became a real.
You knew it.
Yes, I knew it, but Jay Gordon didn't. And in those days, we had the Republic account, we had the Waterman Fountain Pen account, we had the Tucker account, we were doing the Higgins boats. He was a big supplier during the war, New Orleans, and we were doing that post-war 28-foot little family cruiser.
Mm-hmm.
So Lowy, by the same token, had Coca-Cola, Frigidaire, Pennsylvania Railroad, Studebaker. They were all, hey, this was, you could knock at anybody's door if you wanted to. If you had the talent, get the job.
So what did the firm do for what kind of program did they set up?
Well, of course, when you are usually a consultant, there are formula that you normally follow. Number one, you start with sketches, and the committee approves the sketches. Number two, you should build more than one prototype in clay. You want to see, you want to walk around the thing before you say, hey, I want to make 1,000 of them. And why, no, Mr. Tucker says, I can't afford that. I want this thing done. He said, we're going to be in production. It's known as the Tucker 48, and we're going to be in production in the spring of 48. This is spring of 47. Spring of 48, we're going to be in production. Now, remember, across the country, we had Bob Burke, Raymond Lurie producing then the 47 great Studebaker. And you had one out of the hopper already. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler were producing what they had done pre-war. And so I will say
they're
this much.
Back and forth.
Oh, yes, yeah. And the goal here was great. The timing was good. And Preston said, damn it, I've got the money. I know what I want. Don't tell me the torque converter doesn't exist. I've seen it on tanks. Well, for the first time, we knew we were in Chicago. We were birth at the Drake Hotel, very posh.
Oh, yeah.
He was picking up the dollars.
What part of town was the old Dodge engine plant?
Cicero. South and west.
Right.
Oh boy. And
park right in the Drake Hotel.
That's correct. But we would have the cars, they would drive us down. And his family, we had our staff meetings every Friday afternoon at a beautiful suite of his. He had a conference room in his suite.
Where was that?
In the Drake.
Oh, the Drake, okay.
Well, this was posh. This was much better than 500 Fifth Avenue. And a little bit better than Dearborn.
Oh, yeah.
I was in good company. It was great. And I had the knowledge. I had the knowledge. But that sketch that was revealed yesterday, they had no clay. That is true. But it was untrue because the clay they had was plasticine. It's the same stuff that your grandkids use in kindergarten today. And I said, good God, this is ridiculous. But we had to use it. Ultimately, we bought the same stuff that we got from the Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler years. But it was tough putting a good finish on this plasticine. You couldn't do it. But there was the Tremulous car. There was the Lippincott car. Now, the Tucker torpedo that George Larson did, that was gone a year earlier.
Did you have good rapport with Tremulous?
Yes, he knew we were there. How would you like that? He knew we were there.
Okay.
He had a staff. It was very, very similar to Exner and Bob Burke.
Okay.
Very parallel.
Yeah.
Lowy the outside man, Exner the inside man.
Right.
And there we were with zero experience, at least, you know. Alex had headed up the American Bantam in 1939. He'd been all over.
American what?
Bantam.
Oh, yeah.
In Butler, Pennsylvania. He was their chief designer.
Mm-hmm.
He was with, in 1933, he started with Duesenberg in Chicago, not in Auburn, in Chicago on their staff as a stylist. So He got around.
They're responsible for the superchargers on the last court.
Could have been. Yeah. I don't know. This man has bounced and has moved through the automotive society.
He ended up at Briggs with Ralph Roberts.
There you are.
Thunderbolt in the Newport.
That's true. There's hardly a page you can turn that doesn't have a little influence of Alex in there.
Well, can you clear up then for all time who designed the Tucker? Is that an awkward question to ask?
It is not, because the defense will, you will see it in print in the spring of 88.
This will be heard for a couple of years.
It'll be in print, and I've been a bit bashful to reveal it. And as I say, of the two models now, if you recall the steer horn front bumper, that was our concept.
What is that word, steer?
Well, steer Texas steer horn.
Horn.
Yeah, you know, right. How they come down?
Right.
We call that the steer horn bumper. And the back end was ours, and the six little exhaust ports.
Yes.
And
those are functional too.
They are. But, well, they come out of a Y below, I mean, and yes, it showed that you had six cylinders. It was rather revealing, but as to enhancing the performance, sir, I doubt it. But the car that was accepted was the Lippincott car.
Was it?
Absolutely.
Were there any tremulous touches on it at all?
Oh, yes, of course, because they were tremulous on ours, and he had nuances that we had on his. But he didn't have, he had the conventional horizontal bumper. Put this down here.
Any particular items in terms of
got the pictures.
Recognizable features.
Oh, yes. Got the book right here. This is the pilot that had been. This is the one that's in the hands of the publisher.